is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy. I am not Tom Hartman. I am Danielle, here with Shano, in for Tom today, with a big, big, gigantic, humongous show.
Huge.
Huge. Huge, because Sean Taylor is a goddess. Yes. She is the goddess of radio producers. There are none equal to Sean Taylor. Anyhow, lots of big, big stuff in the news today. The FCC being sued over net neutrality. Republicans.
That didn't take long, huh?
No.
Wow.
No,
right,
I think
court.
They had that pre-printed, pre-filled out, little template. Yeah.
Those little, like those little will forms you get in the book.
Yes. Yeah.
How to sue
exactly.
The FCC.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Republicans want to take away our overtime pay. Smithsonian has a exhibit from the Koch brothers.
Yeah.
All kinds of crazy stuff. And a big theme in today's show that we're going to talk about a lot. We all know we have constitutional rights.
Mm-hmm.
We have other rights that aren't necessarily guaranteed by the Constitution, but
they're
that
actually called privileges.
Right. Like public school, our students have the right to public school, may not be in the Constitution, but I think we've pretty well established as a nation that our students have a right to public school. Lots of things we deem very strongly as rights of living in our society. But what good are those rights if you can't access them?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be talking about several different ways that this question hits home in our society, including voting rights and the rights of people who are incarcerated mm-hmm. in jail or prison. But we wanted to start off with a case out of Indiana.
Yeah.
Strange case. Okay. So as I said, I think we've all established that students in this country have a right to a public education, at least through 12th grade.
And you can go even further. In the state of Indiana, their state constitution actually explicitly gives people the right of an education,
wow.
a free public education. So this is they're dealing with the Indiana Constitution here.
So there is no question that in the state
nope.
of Indiana,
none.
Students have a right to an education. However, according to the Indiana Supreme Court, they don't necessarily have a right to get there, to get to school.
Right.
Indiana court ruled this Tuesday that public schools are not constitutionally required to provide school buses
right.
to and from school. This is such an interesting case because it opens up so many questions about our society. Number one, if you have that right in Indiana to a public education, shouldn't you also have the right to get there?
Right. What good is having an open school that you can't access?
Right.
You can't get to.
It certainly begs to question how these Republican policies affect states if they're actually chipping away at these rights that we hold so dear.
Well, this came about in Indiana mostly because the state put a cap on property taxes
mm-hmm.
in the state of Indiana. So as costs go up, populations go up, things cost more. Property taxes were capped. So the income going into schools, because schools get most of their money from property taxes, since those cannot go up, schools don't have enough money to operate. One of the things some of the districts are doing in Indiana is getting rid of busing. And a group of students sued, or their parents sued, saying, you know, we have, under this Indiana Constitution, the right, our children have the right to a free public education, and part of that would be getting them to that education.
Right.
Supreme Court of Indiana disagreed. Like you said, the question is, you have that right. That one's in the Indiana Constitution, the right to an education. But if you can't get there, are you being denied that right?
And I would say that you are. But
the Supreme Court of Indiana says you would not be.
No, they specifically said it will inevitably require some families to make alternative accommodations, but it will not close the schoolhouse doors. Not all families have the means to make alternative accommodations. Are you going to send your kindergartner on a public city bus by himself while you have to go work two
right.
or three jobs to get to school? I mean, there are some hard questions that the state of Indiana has to consider here.
Right.
And it also begs the question of, you know, what is happening to our education system?
Sure.
And where do we want to end up if we're constantly destroying the right of an education?
We have the GOP and many of its candidates saying we need to get rid of the Department of Education, that our United States Constitution does not provide the right to an education,
mm-hmm.
That it's a privilege, And I want to ask the question for conservatives, especially out there, if it's not in the Constitution, and we're supposed to read the Constitution your way, and an education in this country actually is a privilege, what does that country look like? And is that the country you really want to live in?
Right. You know, Republicans love to cite our forefathers, and it was Jefferson himself in a letter to James Madison who wrote, say finally whether peace is best preserved by giving energy to the government or information to the people. The last is the most certain and the most legitimate engine of government. Educate and inform the whole mass of the people. Enable them to see that it is in their interest to preserve peace and order, and they will preserve them. So, I mean, Jefferson, you know, many of our great leaders throughout history have pretty strong stances on
Jefferson,
education.
Jefferson's one of his greatest achievements, according to him, was the establishment of the University of Virginia.
Right. Go read his tombstone.
You have Lincoln, land-grant colleges. FDR proposed the right to an education, a good education, in his second Bill of Rights. He actually did want it added to the Constitution. Should we add it to the Constitution?
I would say that we should. I mean,
should it even be? I think it actually should be implied into the Constitution,
based on language that's
just
already
there. Just because I want it there.
Just because you want it there.
I haven't thought that one through, but I want it there.
Yeah. I mean, what good is the right to an education if you can't access it? And how far are we from simply being a society where only the rich get to be educated? Only the rich,
right.
Or even, you know, maybe not the rich, but only the middle class.
Sure.
And then soon when it becomes too expensive, then it's only the rich.
Haven't we gone back to the country that we fought the revolution to get away from? A country that's based that the only people that succeed, that have that happiness that we are allowed to go for, are those that get it through lineage.
Yeah.
Heredity. That the only way you're going to succeed is if you're born into the right family. Because that family has the money, because it's been consolidated, only you get the education. Only you get the lawyers when you get into trouble.
Right.
You know, there's a lot being said right now about privacy and the internet and things like that. The more money you have, the more likely it is you're able to buy your privacy. You know, you're able to keep your name clean, so to speak,
on
the internet, or keep people from spying on you, keep companies from taking your information.
We may get into that today if we have time. So many topics that we want to get into, but the right to be forgotten is another one.
Sure. The rights, you know, when it comes to being a, because you're going to get into this as well today, if you have been accused of a crime, you're going to get a better lawyer with more money.
Yeah.
That you have a right to an attorney. You have a right against cruel and unusual punishment. But if you can't access the system that will guarantee you that, are you not being denied that right? Because you can't get in front of a judge.
Right.
With a decent legal case.
Exactly. And voting rights. You know, if you happen to live in a poorer minority district, should your voting rights be taken away simply because the people in charge of districting don't necessarily agree with your viewpoints, or they think that all minorities should be grouped together? Another point we're going to get into today.
Well, the thing about the Voting Rights Act is when they had preclearance before the Supreme Court blew it up, it was assumed certain areas that it had been racially biased in the past had to get their new voting laws cleared.
Right.
Now, since that was blown up, you have to sue. And what does it take to sue? Money and time.
Mm-hmm.
It is done after the fact. So blowing that part of the Voting Rights Act up made getting your voting rights in those states more expensive. The thing is, are our rights becoming so expensive that they're prohibitive?
There are so many examples that we came up with before the show. Obviously, this school example is a great one where do you have the right to a public education? What happens if you can't get there? Voting rights, big case out of the Supreme Court, big ruling today we're going to get into. The right of a prisoner. Just because you're behind bars, should you be subject to cruel and unusual punishment? There are so many examples. And I would love to hear from you. What other instances can you think of where you have a right, but you may not be able to access it?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What good are having these rights if we can't use them?
It's time to do away with the word homeland. Ever since it first stole the spotlight with the creation of the Department of Homeland Security in the months after 9/11, the term homeland has become ingrained in American society. But as Chris Matthews pointed out recently, there's something strange and creepy about the term.
I am very uncomfortable with the phrase homeland. It strikes me as totalitarian. It's a term used by the neocons. They love it. It suggests something strange to me. Like, who else are we defending except America? Why don't you just say America? Why does he say we defend against attacks against this country? As if we're facing some existential Armageddon threat from these people. Do you buy the phrase homeland as a reference to America? I never heard it growing up. Never heard it in my adulthood. It's a new word. Why are we using it?
Well, Chris has really hit the nail on the head when it comes to the term homeland. It's important that you know, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story behind this strange term. First, homeland is not a new word at all. In fact, it's been around for a very long time, and in many ways it has a very dark history. As Josh Marshall pointed out over at TPM, the term homeland really does have a deep blood and soil tinge to it, which is distinctly Germanic, more than a touch un-American, and a little bit creepy. That blood and soil that Marshall is referring to was one of the really big slogans of Hitler's Nazi Germany. They called it Blut und Erde, blood and soil. They said, we the Germans are the products of this earth, this soil in Germany, and we are the race unique from all others. Right? That was the German shtick. And perhaps ironically, Hitler stole that term, homeland, from the 1920-1930 Zionist movement, whose goal was to create a Jewish homeland in the Middle East. Hitler wanted to create a racial identity for the German people that was tied to German soil. He wanted to create an identity that went beyond language and culture. He wanted to essentially invent a German race and have Germany be that new German race's homeland, so that he could sell to the German people their own racial superiority and use that racial superiority as a justification to exterminate others, which he did very efficiently. So in 1934, at the Nazi Party's big coming out event, which was the famous six-day Nuremberg rally, Nazis introduced the word homeland. Prior to that, they'd always referred to Germany as the Fatherland, der Vaterland, or the Motherland, or our nation. But Hitler and his think tank wanted Germans to think of themselves with what he and Goebbels viewed as the semi-tribal passion that the Zionists had for Israel. So in that most famous 1934 Nazi rally's opening speech, Rudolf Hess, Hitler's deputy Führer, took to the podium and introduced Germans for the first time to Heimat, the German word for homeland. Heimat was used throughout the reign of Hitler and throughout World War II. Nazis loved the word. They attached it to everything they could, like the Nazi Homeland Defense Force. It's called the Heimwehr. But immediately after Nazi Germany was defeated and World War II came to a close, the word all but disappeared from German vernacular. I know, I lived there for a year. Post-war Germans were ashamed to use a word that stood for such terrible things. Fast forward nearly 70 years, and while Germans still won't say it, the word homeland is everywhere here in the United States now. Bush and Cheney rolled it out in a big way after 9/11, and our media managed to completely ignore the dark history of this word. But it's a history that carries with it a danger. The danger that we may begin to think of ourselves as an exceptional people, a race apart, because of our homeland national identification. That we may start to think of America as a homeland. It's time to retire this artifact of the Nazi era. Let's rename the Department of Homeland Security and remove from America's self-description this dark, strange, and creepy term.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Danielle here with Shano in for Tom today. If you're in L.A. this weekend, March 28th and 29th, join Tom at Sister Giant 3 with Marianne Williamson, Congressman Dennis Kucinich, and Senator Bernie Sanders. Check it out at sistergiant.com or click the link over at tomhartman.com to find out more. Lots of big guests today. We're going to speak with Michael Lee of the Brennan Center to talk about this big ruling out of the Supreme Court.
On gerrymandering.
Yes.
Of all things.
Yes.
Alabama.
Redistricting.
Alabama seems to be the hot spot for dealing with these voting rights.
Yes, Shelby County.
Shelby County was Alabama. And this one actually turned out a little better.
Yeah. So exciting news there we're going to talk about. And Maya Shenwar of Truth Out and Stephanie Mensimer of Mother Jones. Just so far, a big, big day. You're not going to want to go anywhere.
Since we have a lot of guests, we may want to get to calls.
That's what I was reaching to do, especially with all of these great points on the board. Let's check in first with Wesley, watching on Free Speech TV in Hassell, North Carolina. Wesley, thanks for watching the Tom Hartman Program.
Good afternoon. How are you doing today?
We are doing very well. Thank you.
I am a 52-year-old disabled veteran of the Army and the United States Coast Guard. And what I'm the point that I'm going to make, as I serve my country, I realize that the education that I got in the 70s and 80s helped us promote what we are today in the worldwide system that we have today. Now, if they are not able to invest in the system of the young people today, then how is our country just going to grow? And one more other thing when it comes down to the voting rights. Understand that when our Constitution was created, it said all men, and it should have been women's too, are created equal. So should nobody, color, race, creed, sexual orientation, should be excluded from voting, having an option of voting for a system that's for America, which is a country, not just one person, not just one group of people, not just billionaires or rich people, but all people from the lowest to the highest, in order for this country to grow, in order for this country to lead this world into another future. We have to invest into our children, into the people, into the minorities, to all the people who built this country to make it as great as it is today. If we continually fight amongst ourselves about things that are so simple as race, social status, and other things, then we are not, only thing we are doing is tearing down exactly what our creating father was trying to do, which is create a world that all people can be a part of, whether we are against this person or against that person or over here or over there. It does not matter. I defended this country for the one major reason, for the people of this country to live free, to have a right to speak their mind, to do the things that they need to do in order to achieve a prosperous life.
Wesley, all amazing points. Thank you very much, and thank you for your service as well. Yes, thank you, Shane. I was thinking the same thing. That's the type of call that gets me fired up. I don't know about the listeners, but right on so many things, that education shouldn't be looked at as some burden of society. It's an investment. It's a way to shape our future and shape the people who are going to be taking care of this country in before we know it.
And nowadays, more and more, it's seen as a money-making proposition. And privatizing is at the forefront of everything, to destroy the teachers' union and to make as much money as possible. Those should not be the top goals of education. They shouldn't even be in the thought process.
Absolutely. And this Indiana case, Wesley, thank you very much for hanging out with us there on Free Speech TV in North Carolina. This Indiana case, it also begs the question, as more students can't go because they can't get there, schools are usually funded per student. So if you lose enrollment and the enrollment numbers go down, that school is just going to get less funding, which is the reason they're in this predicament to begin with. Right. So it's a shameful cycle.
A death spiral. Yes. It could be even seen.
Absolutely. Let's check in with Mark, watching on DirecTV in Chester, Connecticut. Mark, thanks for watching the Tom Hartman program.
Yes, hi. How are you?
We are doing very well. Thank you.
Good. Thanks for taking the call. You know, Shana was talking about the policies, Republican policies, bringing us back to the English monarchy times where, only wealth matters. And it seems coincidental to me that not only are they bringing us back to the revolutionary pre-American revolutionary times, but it also seems like they're trying to redo the get ready for the next civil war. The South shall rise. It seems like most of these Republican counterparts here come from the South, and policies like paying companies to ship our jobs overseas. I'd like to know how many were Republicans and how many were Democrats, and who also won't sign to bring them back, pay to bring them back. It's going to be the same people.
Pelosi brought up a bill that would give tax credits for bringing jobs back and tax bills for shipping jobs overseas, the reverse of what it is right now. The Democratic House of Representatives, back when it was controlled by Democrats, passed that. It went to the Senate and was filibustered by Republicans. So I can tell you exactly who on that last point.
Right. It's not always clear cut on the whole free trade argument, as we see President Obama supporting the TPP, which I believe we're going to talk about tomorrow. But I do think that there is an effort to move backwards in time, whether it's the revolutionary period, yeah. whether it's pre-civil rights, whether it is back to the Reagan years. I'm not quite sure.
Well, and the Civil War thing generally would come out of, I would think, that there's definitely a movement that's anti-federal government. And, of course, the Civil War was exactly that. So a lot of the language that is anti-D.C., the secessionist type of things, have a lot of echoes from that point in time. I don't think anyone's going back to slavery.
Right.
But there's certainly states' rights arguments being made.
There's certainly several secessionist movements that have popped up. Lots of great points. Thank you for listening there in Connecticut, Mark. We appreciate the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
What good are voting rights if we can't access them? Michael Lee of the Brennan Center for Justice, coming up next to talk about that. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Danielle here with Shano in for Tom today. And, of course, if you are following the news today, you may have seen that the Supreme Court sided with Alabama in a big case about redistricting. Rather than try and explain that myself and possibly mess it up for you, we're going to speak with Michael Lee, counsel of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, BrennanCenter.org, at Brennan Center on Twitter, and at MCPLI. For Michael himself. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today on such short notice about such exciting news.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
For anybody who missed this case back in, I believe it was November, when they heard arguments before the court, could you give a little breakdown about how this case came to be and the redistricting that occurred after the last census?
Sure. So, you know, every 10 years there's redistricting, and that took place in Alabama. What happened in Alabama that was a little unusual was that Alabama decided that in order to comply with the Voting Rights Act, what it needed to do was to keep the African-American population of districts at the same level that they were, even if you had to add people to a district to equalize the population among districts. In other words, if a district was 70% African-American, it needed to be 70% African-American after redistricting. The challenge was that many of these districts were underpopulated, so you needed to add people. The question was whether you added nearby white people or whether you had to go out of your way to find African-American people to add to the districts. Adding white people nearby would make the districts, you know, maybe 65, 62% African-American. Alabama decided it couldn't do that. Instead, it needed to redraw the districts radically, including dumping white people out of districts in order to have very high percentages of African-Americans, and African-Americans say that actually hurt their voting strength.
So while some would argue in that state that they're just doing this to be fair, there's certainly a case to be made that this was concentrating African-American voters in Alabama into the fewest number of districts possible, giving them the least amount of representation in the legislature. Is that correct?
That's right. That's the argument that, you know, African-American voters were packed into a handful of districts. You know, oftentimes these were very unwieldy, attenuated districts where, you know, you didn't necessarily know people in another county. And so, you know, they made it very hard to run. But it also diluted strength because there were districts where African-Americans were starting to work with white voters and build coalitions, and this destroyed all of that and made the surrounding districts much much more white and frankly much more Republican. So
the Supreme Court heard this argument back in November. I want to quickly remind everybody we're speaking with Michael Lee of the Brennan Center for Justice about big news out of the Supreme Court today. They ruled the easiest summary I've been using so far is in favor of Alabama, but if I'm understanding this correctly, they didn't come right out and say that Alabama, their redistricting policy was unconstitutional or a violation of the Voting Rights Act. Am I understanding that correctly?
You are. They sent the court back. They sent the case back down to the district court, the federal district court in Alabama, and said basically the court had gotten the standard wrong, and the court needed to look at each district and decide whether that district had been drawn predominantly on the basis of race. In other words, whether there was packing in that district, instead of looking at the map as a whole. There will be more litigation on this, and the outcome ultimately isn't clear. I mean, you know, the maps could, this case could end up back at the Supreme Court, and the maps could be upheld. But there'll basically be a second bite at the apple now for the plaintiffs.
But given this court's history on voting rights, I'd say it's at least a bit of a victory that they didn't just come right out and say, no, those districts are fine. You can keep African Americans in 3, 4, 5 districts. That's all they need.
That's right. I mean, you can read this opinion as saying that Alabama needed to take the Voting Rights Act much more seriously than it did. It couldn't apply what the court called a mechanistic interpretation of the act, and basically, you know, that it really had to take it seriously and try to use the act in ways that actually enhance the voting power of African Americans and not use it merely as an excuse for actually diluting the power of African Americans.
It's always a couple different ways to read certain statutes like that. They tend to read the ones that don't sit so well with me personally. There's been a lot of challenges to voting laws, of course, in Texas, I believe in North Carolina, other states around the country. Does this case have any effect on those other cases, or is it kind of standalone, a different situation than what's going on in some of those other states?
Well, it certainly could have some impacts in a number of other states, North Carolina and Virginia being two of them, because really what you saw throughout the South this last redistricting cycle was something very similar. You know, a desire to sort of pack African Americans into a handful of districts, justify that by saying that you're trying to comply with the Voting Rights Act and help African Americans when you're actually undermining their voting strength. And, you know, so you see this play out in many places in the South, including North Carolina and Virginia, and there have been similar claims brought in those states. And so this opinion could have an impact on those cases. It'll remain to be seen. You know, they'll have to raise those in those cases, but it could have a broader impact beyond Alabama, for sure.
Is there anything to stop the redistricting? I don't know if it's a committee. I don't recall the facts of the case this many months out, if it's a committee in Alabama or lawmakers that do it. But is there anything to stop that body from simply copying states like Texas and say, you know, we're not redistricting based on race. We're just doing it because they're Democrats.
That's one of the new arguments that they got
made.
The cycle, and it used to be that you couldn't make that argument because, you know, in the South, the white people and black people, you know, voted in the Democratic primary, but now things have become so polarized. You know, that's going to be one of the major challenges, and that's going to actually be an issue the Supreme Court could take up at some future point, perhaps out of Texas or elsewhere, because, you know, that is an argument that now is available now that white people mostly vote in the Republican primary and minorities vote in the Democratic primary, and it's an argument that can be made, and that, you know, the court is going to have to decide how to factor in race and partisanship.
Yeah, Democrat is not a protected class, but it certainly is quite brazen that they use that argument. I'm afraid I'm going to see it pop up in other places. As it stands now, what's the effect of this ruling? Does it put in jeopardy the current districts as they're drawn? Do they have to go back and consider it, or is this still on pause while the courts continue to hash it out?
Well, it's still on pause right now because what will happen is the case will go back down to the district court in Alabama, and they'll have to have new hearings and decide, looking at the evidence, whether there was a racial gerrymandering going district by district. There basically will be a redo of the trial. And so the maps are still good and they're still in effect until that process gets completed.
It really is strange how many cases we've seen since the formula in the Voting Rights Act was struck down by the Supreme Court. Is there any movement on that you're aware of? I know, you know, Sensenbrenner was trying to get that formula back into play. Any hopes that we'll get a meaty, valid Voting Rights Act back in the near future?
Well, you know, there have been a number of acts, you know, dealing with voting that have been introduced. You know, it's not clear that is a priority in the current Congress, but with the recent anniversary in Selma, a lot of recent movement, I think that, you know, this is there's an opportunity to try to build consensus around what should be something that is pretty fundamental, is making sure that everyone has the right to vote and that their votes are counted.
Yeah, it seems pretty fundamental, pretty much what this country is supposed to be about. What can people, whether they be in Alabama or Texas, where it's okay to discriminate against Democrats or any other of these states, what can they do to help push these movements along and help protect voting rights in their state?
Well, I think obviously the number one thing is to make sure that you go out and you vote. You know, the U.S. had extraordinarily low voter turnout in 2014 and has historically had low voter turnout compared to other countries. But beyond that, you know, make sure that you get engaged, you talk to your representatives and your legislators, and make sure that they understand how this really sort of impacts you beyond sort of one party winning or the other party. It's very easy for people in Washington and you know, for political types to always view this as my team versus the other team. But these decisions actually have real impacts on the lives of people, and they need to hear that because, you know, they will instantly think, does this help me or does it hurt my party? And, you know, that they need to understand that this is not just about partisanship, that this is really about something that's much more fundamental to our nation.
Yeah, it certainly is. I think it is at the core of our democracy, so to say. You know, after people get involved and they check with their local centers, what's going on over at BrennanCenter.org that they can get involved in?
Well, we are obviously, you know, people, we would love you to sign up on our website and check out all the news that we have. You know, there's certainly, we are involved with a lot of groups, you know, trying to, you know, work with them on proposals for new legislation. You know, Oregon just recently had a very exciting bill that passed where the state is actually automatically registering people who have driver's licenses, so you don't have to go through the extra step of registering. You have the right still to opt out and say, I really don't want to participate, but it's the first state that where the burden of registering voters will be on the state. You know, there's certainly a lot of movement on a lot of other bills, and this is a very active legislative session, and so our website has a lot of great updates on that, and you can find out what's kind of going on maybe in your community, both in the good sense and in the bad sense, and certainly take action from that.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for breaking this case down for us, and hopefully you'll come back when there's more resolution.
I'd be glad to. Thanks for having me.
Michael Lee, Council Democracy
Hartman.
Program.
Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Council Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. That is BrennanCenter.org. Check it out and see how you can get involved. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program here on Free Speech TV.
I wanted to ask him about mandatory voting.
Mandatory voting? Oh, that's such a great topic.
I really did, because we've been going through that analysis where, you know, part of the First Amendment is the right to not speak.
Yeah.
And is forcing people to speak and forcing them and therefore to vote or finding them if they don't. Is that a violation of the First Amendment? But not enough time, because that's a really interesting gerrymandering case.
It really is. I mean, it's there's always two sides to looking at a particular provision.
Otherwise there wouldn't be court cases.
Right, but they managed to find the most damaging way to look at it.
Yeah.
We're supposed to protect and not discriminate by race, so we're going to make sure all of you African Americans are in one district.
That was a really twisted reasoning, and then to turn it on its head and therefore say, see?
Right.
We did this for this reason. No, you didn't.
No, they didn't.
No, you didn't.
Oh, let's check.
But that's what the trial is going to be about now under the new standard. So that's what essentially is going
to
happen.
It's going to go back to the courts.
Yep.
Hey, it's better than...
One thing the Supreme Court will not do normally, and unless it's a case of first impression, in which case they send it off to a referee. You know, there's very few things you can go right to the Supreme Court on. Very, very few, and it happens so infrequently. The court's not going to sit there and haggle over facts. They just don't. They're not going to try a case. They never have. Well, they really used to, I shouldn't say never. They used to long, 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 long ago, but not in recent history.
Yeah.
So that's why they send it back. You know, using this new standard, you trial court, look at the facts, apply the law we just told you to apply, and then we'll see you again.
Yeah. It's something to watch. You know, hopefully we get a few more victories like Oregon, like this case, at least, you know, not a defeat. And voting rights get protected.
Ooh,
because
we didn't lose.
Yes. It's a pretty sad standard, but I'll take it today.
Yeah.
I will take it.
Yeah.
Let's go to calls real quickly and check in with Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, watching on Free Speech TV. How's it going, Bob?
Hey, pretty good. Let me get you off speaker.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I want to go back to what you were saying.
Public education.
By the way, you guys are doing a fantastic job there.
Oh, thank you, Bob.
Yes, indeed. Public education. Back to the first of the show. I put a high value on public education. I've watched it deteriorate through my entire lifetime. What needs to happen, and what's rarely talked about, is that in whatever community or city you're in, the people need to get behind the public educators and the people in the larger political system who support public education at the local level.
Yeah.
Because that's where you have the community and the educators and the people running the school system interacting with each other, and that's where it works.
Yeah, but somehow always get these communities.
How much money is pulled out?
Yeah, somehow they always get these communities to attack the teachers, the people who are, you know, they rail against unions.
Well, that's what I want to talk about.
Yep.
Now, where I'm from, in Oklahoma, here in eastern Oklahoma, in a small town, there's just not a lot of union activity going on. It doesn't really mean much. Okay, but I'm all for unions. I think for every good reason that's been stated that unions are good, I agree with.
Yep.
And I'm all for it. But what I'm saying is on the local, if your education system, if the school system where your kids are is being ravaged, then the people, the parents, have to take accountability and get that fixed. And
yep. Bob, I am sorry we are clear out of time, but right on, absolutely right. Thank you. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I am Danielle here with Shano, sitting in for Tom today. And by the way, if you want to connect on Twitter, you can follow Shano at Producer Shano, and you can follow me at Danielle on Radio. If you want to connect, it's a good way to share messages and news stories.
I know my Twitter blew up this week.
Yeah, cool. And let us know what you're watching in the news and following. And, you know, we do pay attention to that stuff. Mm-hmm. So thank you. Should we go back to calls?
I would like to.
All right. Let's check in with Russell, listening on WCPT in Hickory Hills, Illinois. Thanks for listening to WCPT, Russell.
Hi, yes. Thanks for taking my call. You know, this might sound kind of cruel, but cutting this buses and that, they should look at their parents. They keep voting these Republicans in office to control their state. When are they going to wake up and say, these guys are killing the state? Because they don't call Indiana the Mississippi of the North for an unfounded reason. I don't know what state you live in.
Yeah.
You in Illinois?
No, we are not in Illinois. We are in D.C., Maryland, Virginia. Depends on which staff member you're talking to. You know, we're from Maryland. But it think about that guest we just had on, Russell. There are so many states where people aren't getting the representatives they want to vote for. They don't, you know, they're being cut out of the voting process, whether that be through voter ID or disenfranchisement or redistricting.
Or mounds and mounds of money.
Right.
And it's a vicious cycle then.
Right. You know, what do we do for those people? Like, think about Texas. There are so many great progressives. I talk to them every day working in this job who live in Texas. But if you think about the state as a whole, you would think, hey, they get what they deserve. I understand the sentiment. But how do we have that sentiment and protect the people who don't get what they want while voting?
Get Scalia and let him drop dead. I hate to say that. Maybe we'll get somebody better in the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I certainly disagree with Scalia. I don't wish any physical harm on him, but I understand the sentiment. I understand being upset about his decisions.
I would love it if he would decide to retire.
That would be okay
and
by
enjoy, me. Enjoy the rest of his life vacationing and giving speeches at Coke events. We
yes.
wish no ill.
Anybody
he's
who
a brilliant guy. I've said that over and over again.
Yeah.
There's not a, you may disagree with half of the justices up there, but every one of them is brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
And anybody who's listened to Shane and I, our previous show, Talking Left, yeah. knows how we feel about Scalia, but we don't wish him physical
no.
harm.
No.
No. Let's check in with Rebecca in Everett, Washington. Rebecca, thanks for hanging out with us today on the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, Danielle. I want to give everybody something to think about.
Okay.
I, like everybody else, feel like I'm running around, a fireman running around with a hose, not knowing which fire to put out first.
Yeah.
And because there's so many incredible fights that we have here, and it looks to me like they're kind of tying our hands. And the reason I'm saying this is Shane said something yesterday that made me really think about things. I'm a human service person, and so I kind of backed up and I wanted to take a look at the big picture, because Shane said, what would, you know, this 1% or this 85 billionaires, and they're not probably all on board with this, gain from having all this happen, you know, having all the funds and everything. And then you start looking at things, and I thought, okay, Congress is more like a CEO now because big money has bought them, and they probably don't even know it.
I think you're right, and I think they do know it. In my opinion, I think this idea of running government like a business, I see you mentioned that to Troy, who's
right.
screening calls for us today. I think that they are deliberately trying, that they think government needs to be run like a business, which is pretty scary, considering we almost had a Mitt Romney president.
Yeah, I want American people to think about this, because big money also buys plans and how to use things against people. And they know we're intelligent. They know we're going to run around trying to put out all these fires. But I think our focus needs to be with the government, right at the government, because we're not holding Congress accountable for any of these things that they've been doing. And when has that ever happened? That has never, ever happened.
Yeah,
and
well,
so
we are the government.
Yeah, we are. But if we were a business that was being taken over by a CEO, we the people would probably get the money together and buy our own business. And I thought, okay, what would they gain by taking over America and running it like a business? Well, for one, when they get rid of all the unions and everything else, they'd have us at their mercy. And we would be having to work for the dollar or, you know, I owe my soul to the company store kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then not only that, we wouldn't be having education to get ourselves out of there. We would be back, you know, like 40 years and put back. And plus, it would make them more competitive in the world with, you know, earning money as business. And then I thought, well, what about all the wars? Why would they want, all, you know, a continuous war? Well, continuous war would weed out a lot of people. For every person that was lost in that war, there'd be possibly seven kids that would come on board. And it would just make it a richer planet for all these people to have this money.
Yeah,
I know that's a little out there. I'm sorry.
That's not that far out.
Yeah.
It could be.
I don't think you're that far out there. I do think that it's a matter of, you know, it is all about money. They do try and run this country like a business. And the scary part in that frame of mind is we're just another one of the resources.
Right.
You know.
And when I asked that question, it wasn't I can understand that there are certain people who have a hoarding mentality and want to be as rich as possible. Okay, and too, there's no such thing as too rich. But I think what I was getting more at is when Tom quotes a gentleman from Europe who's saying, I don't want to be a rich man in a poor country.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see the benefit of being super wealthy when you're essentially living among the distraught, the downtrodden, and you're just living in this terrible world. I don't see the benefit of being rich on an awful planet. That's what I think what I was trying to get at.
Yeah, I completely agree. Rebecca, all wonderful points. And I don't think you're that far out there. I think the reason you feel this way and that you think they're trying to run government like a business is because that's what they're doing. I mean, they're trying to streamline, you know, if you think about Mitt Romney breaking it off and selling it in pieces. Look at they tried to sell off the national parks. They're working on
sure.
that. You have the conservative budget that wants to streamline the government by destroying, you know, the NLRB, the EPA, the, you know.
It reminds you of the old saying from the early 20s, pre-depression, more government and business and less business and government.
Yeah.
I think I got that right.
Sounds
or the
right
reverse.
To me. Sounds
reverse.
Right, but.
Less government and business and more business and government.
Yes. I'm sure callers will let us know if you said it wrong.
Oh, yeah.
So, anyhow, lots in store. Maya Shenmar of Truth Out coming up next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartmann Program with me, Danielle, and Shano, sitting in for Tom today. And we've been talking a lot about rights and what good are they if you can't use them. One of the largest portions of our population who has rights that they seem to never be able to access are prison and jail inmates. You know, they're often subjected to what I would define as cruel and unusual punishment, if not worse. They often lose voting rights. There's lots of ways that our prison system, our jail system has failed them. Speaking on that subject, joining us now, Maya Shenhwar, editor-in-chief of Truthout and author of a new book, Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. Maya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. We talked a little bit about the Supreme Court in another case today, but I was astounded by a recent news story of Supreme Court Justices Kennedy and Breyer essentially coming out and saying what you have been saying for some time, that our prison system is broken. What do you think about their comments and about this idea that we can do better with inmates?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really heartening to hear Breyer and Kennedy speaking out. I think it's important to note that they're speaking out on very particular issues, but they were saying overall that the system is a mess. And I think that's something a lot of us can agree on. Specifically, they were focused on solitary confinement, which actually the United States has one of the highest percentages of people in solitary confinement right now in prison. We have the latest estimate, I think, was 80,000 people in solitary confinement. And the UN and all kinds of international bodies have called solitary confinement torture and condemned it. And also the justices spoke out about mandatory minimums. And this is something Breyer has actually been very consistent on. This idea that having mandatory sentencing times, that someone who commits a certain crime gets a certain prison term, is actually a really, really bad idea, but it's pervasive in the justice system.
In addition to aspects like how much it costs us to incarcerate people, how much it costs us as a society to have all of this lost productivity and lost revenue, there is a moral aspect here, if not a legal one, of prisoners really being denied rights that I would say are guaranteed to them in this country. What do you say to certain people who respond and say that prisoners don't have these rights, that we shouldn't worry about the people who have committed crimes and who are in our justice system?
Well, I think that people who respond that way, there are a couple of elements there. First of all, when it comes to the criminal legal system, there's always an underlying element of racism, first and foremost.
Absolutely.
Also, ableism, classism, people making those judgments, there's usually a coded racist and particularly anti-Black message behind it. Prison is grounded in those structures. But also, I think that we've developed this rhetoric since the 70s, really, with this tough on crime politics that so many lawmakers have spouted and that was all over the media and really like developed into this thing that everyone assumed was common sense. really, we're talking about people who have done something. You know, when you think of a crime as actually an act that someone has done, rather than framing prisoners as, you know, criminals or people who are inherently bad, then you start to think, what's going on here? And actually, there was a recent study in which 90% of youth, teenagers, admitted that they had done something that constitutes a crime. Of course, the people being locked up for those crimes are generally poor people of color, but all of us, or most of us, have done something that falls in that category. So these people that have a kind of lock them up and throw away the key and they don't need rights attitude, really, I think are reacting in part out of fear and self-fear.
I absolutely agree. And, I look around the world at how so many other developed nations deal with crime in general, and especially certain acts that we consider crimes that aren't considered crimes overseas, like drug policy. How is it that in this day and age, we're still using policies and practices like solitary confinement, locking somebody away for 23 hours a day, or that someone could end up in prison, as Kennedy and Breyer talk about, for 15 years, essentially for maybe growing a pot plant?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a set of policies that have developed over the course of, first of all, the past 40 years of kind of building this drug war that some of the policies you spoke of grew out of. And that, I think, is something that is particularly unique to our country. But another thing is, again, this grounding in racism and how some of these laws that we have now are not based on safety, even in the minds of those who made them. They grew out of kind of this intrinsic anti-Black racism that's built into the justice system, starting from slavery, really. At the end of slavery, the 13th Amendment said people convicted of a crime can still be enslaved. So from there forward, people were being incarcerated for all kinds of reasons besides the ones that they were actually arrested for. So I think we definitely have to keep that in mind. And absolutely, all kinds of other countries, I think, are not only carrying out more humane policies, but even making those policies more humane. Just recently, Belgium announced that it is abolishing prison sentences under a year. So people convicted of crimes that would garner prison sentences under a year will not be sent to prison.
That's amazing. You know, I've been studying this subject probably not as closely and as long as you have, but from back in, you know, when I was in college, and the statistics, even from the government, you know, themselves, show that our policies don't work. They cost our nation a ton of money. They typically lead to people being reincarcerated. They don't reintroduce people into society. And in the cases of what Kennedy and Breyer are talking about, I think that they are torture, you know, locking somebody up with no human contact for up to months at a time. Can't we do better as a nation?
Absolutely. And I think that some of those things you mentioned are actually messages that are resonating more broadly right now. And more people are starting to understand, you know, if 66% of people coming out of prison are rearrested within 3 years, is the system really a correctional system or a rehabilitative system as it brands itself? It's not the case. And so I think part of doing better is really decarceration, simply imprisoning fewer people. And part of that is about changing laws, and part of it is really about changing the way policing happens. And that's where some of the Black Lives Matter protests and other movements going on right now come into play, is that this is not only about changing sentencing laws, it's also about changing who gets arrested and how many people get arrested. Also, I think we really need to think about building alternatives to how we deal with harm, including things that are not just, you know, a little bit of drug possession, but other things, because prison, as you said, it doesn't work. It's not teaching people not to do things that harm other people, and also, especially especially keeping people in isolation, actually fuels and provokes mental illness.
Yep.
So, yeah.
There is so much I think we can do better, starting with making sure people go out and read your amazing book, Maya Shenhua, author of Lockdown, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. Thank you, Maya.
Thank you so much.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Just because somebody is convicted of a crime, should they be denied Eighth Amendment rights and subjected to cruel and unusual punishment? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program.
Danielle, did you know? You know, when you see all these cop shows and when people get arrested, they have your Miranda rights. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to this, that, the other thing. You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided to you. This is one of those situations in which you have a right that costs money, and the government said this right is so important that if you don't have money, we're going to give it to you anyways. Okay? Once you've been convicted, unless it's a capital case, you lose that right to a lawyer. So if you lose your case and you want to appeal, that's, again, one of those rights that really isn't a right. You have to go hire that a lawyer. That's why you have so many people writing appeals from prison, because they're not going to pay for your lawyer on appeal. Did you know that?
And how often do we hear about stories where somebody is wrongfully convicted, even as far as, you know, these death row cases? We mm-hmm. hear about people being wrongfully convicted.
A lot of the science behind that it takes to exonerate people who have been wrongly convicted is really expensive.
Right.
That's why the Innocence Project and all those are so vitally important. But we should be doing that anyways. Shouldn't we?
Absolutely.
If we want to get it right, shouldn't we be funding that?
I think we should be spending more on rehabilitation programs, on, you know, trying to stop the social causes of crime to begin with. Like, you know, we talked yesterday about a basic minimum income.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times people turn to crime because they have no other financial alternative.
Sure.
You know, I think there are many ways we could take some of this money that we spend just locking people away
right.
and invest it in ways to keep people out of prison instead of putting them in.
I agree.
Anyhow, with that said, back to your calls. Let's check in with Diane watching on Free Speech TV in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Thanks for spending time with us today, Diane. Diane. Well, I will put you back on hold, Diane, and see if you are listening to your TV. Let's check in with Leonard watching DirecTV in South Pasadena, California. Thanks, Leonard, for spending time with us today.
Hi, how are you?
Doing very well, thank you.
Okay, this is regarding a friend of mine, a lady I was taking care of. She was a mental patient.
Mm-hmm.
I was, taking care of her and taking her doctor's appointments and all this. And then eventually, she gets arrested because she's somewhat of a kleptomaniac. Then she goes to jail, decides not to tell me anything, goes to jail, is there for nearly 3 months and dies there.
Ugh.
Now, the reason for the death is they just didn't have the proper facilities to handle someone as ill as my friend Sarah.
Yeah, well,
we didn't care. We kept
There is a rash of these type of stories all throughout the country. That's actually what our next guest in about, 45 minutes or so is going to be talking about, Stephanie Mensimer, about why are we not just incarcerating the mentally ill, but executing them. And then there's also this story out of Florida. I don't know if you saw this one about lots of prisoners suddenly dying, some mentally ill in Florida, and inspectors being prevented from talking about it. This is happening all over the country.
Yeah, we still don't know what caused the death of Sarah. They won't tell us.
I believe it, Leonard. And in this day and age in our society, that should not even be... It should sound like conspiracy theory. It should sound like some extreme example. But I have multiple stories just like that sitting on my desk right now in preparation for our next guest. We can do better. This is not American exceptionalism, or at least not the way I would like to talk about it. Thanks for the call. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Big thanks to Maya Shenhua, editor-in-chief of Truth Out. You can check out all their work at truthout.org and find links to Maya's amazing new book. Lots of great people want to weigh in on this. Let's check in with Wayne in Chicago, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hi, Wayne. Thanks for listening to WCPT. Wayne?
That was my fault.
Sorry. Shano forgot to press the button.
Oh, can you hear me?
We can hear you now.
Okay, yeah. I see you guys are talking about the prison industrial complex right now. I want to comment on that, but first I want to comment on this TPP secret trade deal that they're trying to get pushed through Congress.
Okay. I think we're going to talk about that tomorrow, but it's a topic that I think is relevant for more than one day. It's a big deal.
Right. Is it okay if I talk about it now?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead, Wayne.
Okay, yeah, I just wanted to say when they had a meeting last week with the certain members of Congress, and that meeting was actually classified.
Mm-hmm.
They can't even take notes on what's being presented to them, what's being said. So what I want to say to everybody, I'm just going to put it right out on the table and say it bluntly. Whoever supports, whatever politician supports this TPP trade deal is a backstabber to every single American citizen. When Bill Clinton was running against Ross Perot, made a statement that there's a whooshing sound that you're going to hear.
Yeah, I think that wasn't the phrase he used, but
sucking sound.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, and man, was he ever right, huh?
Right. We lost 50,000 factories, 10 million jobs. The same exact thing is going to happen if this trade deal is passed.
Yeah.
So what I want to say is the same thing Mike Papantonio was talking about Sunday night. You are the enemy of every United States citizen if you vote for this deal. So while the Republicans are coming to the front door ringing the doorbell, you got these Democrats coming through the back door stabbing everybody in the back trying to pass secret trade deals.
Yeah, Wayne.
So I want to say the same thing Mike Papantonio said the other night. Whatever Democrat votes for this trade deal, cut them completely off as far as campaign contributions completely, because they are your enemy. It's a totally disastrous trade deal, so nobody should be pushing it. And Nancy Pelosi's talking about she's looking for a way to say yes to the deal.
Okay. Well, yeah, Wayne, I totally get your point. I completely understand. And we are going to talk about it tomorrow. I agree that it's a big deal, and that I don't want candidates that support disastrous policy like that. And that, you know,
it is certainly stabbing every single working American in the back.
Yeah.
There are there's a handful of Americans who are going to make off like bandits. And we're talking about the multi-billionaires.
Well, this is another aspect, and I don't know if Wayne meant it this way or if it's just coincidental. It's another aspect of where we have a right to a representative government that we are not getting. You know, we all have a say in this, regardless of what you think about trade policy. You might be all for free trade. Do you really know that's what we're getting in the TPP?
Right.
Think
about the number of times just about on every policy where the majority of the Americans are behind one policy and the Congress does the complete opposite.
Yep.
Gun control. 90% of people were in favor of background checks, closing the gun show loophole, filibustered, never became. Is that a representative democracy?
I certainly don't think it is.
No.
And, you know, I am all for we might have to elect some lawmakers that are more free trade than I would like, because we don't have a better option in that area. But those are the places, you know, people need to get involved in their local political parties. They need to be precinct committee chairmen, make sure that they have control over who gets on that next ticket, to put progressives on the ticket, to put people who will stand up for American workers and not be afraid.
There are definitely Democrats who are standing up.
Yes.
Sherrod Brown, Bernie Sanders are
Alan Grayson.
Yeah.
Yes. They are out there.
Yeah.
You know, we need to be supportive of people like that. Let's check in with Ann listening on Sirius in Ormond Beach, Florida. Hi, Ann. Thanks for listening to Sirius.
Hi.
Hi.
Today I was listening about the prisons, and I think if we have to include privatized prisons.
Absolutely.
We're really going to talk about the horrors of what's going on. I mean, prison for profit, that's just an idea that's just horrific.
Yeah, it's the evil twin of profiting off of healthcare. You know, profiting off of just parts of our society that I just cannot understand the moral way you make money out of that part of society.
Yeah, and hopefully you guys and Tom will talk more about privatizing, because that's what the Republicans have in mind for every part of our life, everything.
Yeah.
So I think we just got to get that out to the public.
Well, and you being from Florida, I'm also a Florida native, private prisons, I think pretty much almost every major prison in the state down there is private, if I remember correctly.
Well, I'm not that sure of those statistics, but knowing that Rick Scott is our governor again, we know that things are not being done well. They're being done for money.
Yeah. I absolutely agree, and nobody should be making a profit off of prison.
Right. The reason for our criminal justice system in dealing with criminals, or people who commit crimes, more accurately, retribution, to keep people from doing it again, to protect society. Among those, there is not profit. There
right.
should not have been. There should not be now. It was not there before. And all of the other goals, specifically rehabilitation, is completely out of the system when you put profit into it.
Yep.
It's actually contrary to the goals that the criminal justice system is supposed to be about.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden you want more prisoners instead of more active members of society. And thank you, excellent point, and thanks for listening to Sirius.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
What rights can you think of that we should have, but maybe we don't have access to? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Danielle, here with Shano, in for Tom today. And if you are in L.A., this weekend, March 28th and 29th, Tom will be speaking on Saturday along with former Congressman Dennis Kucinich and Senator Bernie Sanders at Sister Giant 3. You can check it out at sistergiant.com. And if you're not in L.A., you can certainly watch that on live stream as well. So be sure to head on over to tomhartman.com and check it out. Lots of big news. And lots of people want to weigh in on today's topics. Lots of great calls on the board. Let's check in with Charlie, listening on Sirius in Duluth, Minnesota. Thanks for listening to the Tom Hartman Program, Charlie.
Thanks. Two points.
Sure.
After I say a good job filling in for Tom, doing a great job.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. First is the demonization of the criminals.
Mm-hmm.
People who commit crimes are human beings just like everybody else in this country. And, you know, the more we like your one caller there was talking about, the more you make it out to be the bad guy, the more easier it is for politicians and law enforcement people to lock these people away and forget about them. And then they eventually get out, but they have no social skills that allow them to be a part of society. But the other thing I wanted to mention was the voting, and why do we still have an electorate? Why is it so difficult for us to for my vote to go directly to the president instead of having an electorate in the middle, and that way you wouldn't have the people's vote would actually be what you see in Congress in the White House.
You mean an electoral college? Why do we still have the electoral college and
Correct.
A representative voting
right.
system?
Right.
It's a good question.
Then, like, the midterms from 2014. You know, more Democrats were voted for than Republicans, but who now controls the Congress?
Yeah, I certainly don't know. I certainly don't know all of the ins and outs of how it would work. I would think that in this day and age, we should be able to accomplish a national popular vote, at least on national issues.
You're talking about having a direct democracy?
Yeah.
Ooh.
A direct democracy.
Wow.
Wouldn't that be something scary, huh?
Well, if there would have to be two absolute precursors for that, though. One, and most important of all, you would have to get money out of politics, because it's so easy to dump a whole ton of money into an issue, confuse voters, mislead, lie.
Yep.
And, you know, we've seen propositions about labeling foods go down in places like California because so much money is spent. So if we could get money out of politics and have an informed electorate, sure. And actually have some leisure time, too, where we have living weight. And we're talking about, you know, huge hurdles to overcome. If people had, you know, 100% or near 100% information that was accurate and the time to know the issues. But have you read one of these bills, by the way, ever?
Charlie?
That we'd be voting on?
Oh, God, no.
Can you imagine requiring every American citizen? Yeah.
Well, but here's the thing.
Uh-huh.
We already have money in politics.
Sure.
And I think that most Americans, it's going to be, eventually it's going to come out just like it was with the CIA spying on its own Americans, or NSA.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Big Brother, you know, used to hear that in the 80s and 90s, oh, Big Brother's watching. And then all of a sudden Snowden comes out and it's like, oh my gosh, they really are.
Right.
Well, same thing with politics. You know, you're going to find more of these, you know, Menards that are buying politicians, you know, and it's going to come more and more real, and you're never going to get away from that.
Yeah, I don't think we need to wait for that. I don't think we need to wait for that to come out. I think it's pretty clear.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's clear right
when
now.
You have politicians essentially going to kiss the ring of Shelley Adelson and the Koch brothers, and, you know, whatever, if you, you know, I know conservatives are going to freak out and say, oh, George Soros and blah, blah, blah. I don't care if it's on the left or the right. I don't want billionaires controlling our system. Maybe a populist vote is a way to defeat money. I mean, just if you had everybody voting, just like President Obama just said, everybody was voting, that would be the best way to overcome the money in politics. I like the idea, Charlie. I don't know if there's parts of it I don't understand or parts of how it works.
I really question the practicality.
But I'm all for everybody actually.
Does everyone have time in their day to go do roll call? You know,
not on every issue, but you know, we could certainly have a national vote. First of all, on presidents. Not have the electoral college.
I'm getting aside of that. I'm talking about, you know, direct democracy in terms of legislation.
Yeah. You know, on issues, how about for constitutional issues?
Well, we already have that. Somewhat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Direct democracies can be difficult.
No.
I really think that money can get in the way. Just the mechanics of it can be really difficult.
Well. We will have to see. Obviously, Shano and I are split.
Yes,
on that one.
Definitely. I wonder what other people think. Then.
Yeah, so
if
we'll
we're
have
split
to see.
On it, it could
exactly.
be a good talk radio topic.
But Charlie, thank you for listening to Sirius there in Minnesota. Let's check in with Ken watching on the Dish Network in Parenton, Michigan. Thanks for hanging out with us today, Ken.
Not a problem. You guys are doing a great job.
Thank you. You guys really don't have to say that, and I swear we're not putting you up to it.
Well, anyway, this kind of goes with everything we talk about, and what I would like to say is, if we don't turn things around, this is where we're going to end up, and this might be accurately describe it, and we would have to change the name of our country to Confederate States of AmeriCorp.
Mm.
Well, have you seen which movie is it? Yeah, which movie is it? Is it Idiocracy? Where all the corporations have taken over the country?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
You know, AmeriCorp, that just pretty much would describe us better than America. Because America kind of symbolizes, you know, absolute freedom and that sort of thing. Where AmeriCorp would pretty much describe how things are run.
I wish I could disagree.
A lot of that is coming from our Confederate states. And to talk about being administered by business and Christian Taliban, that's pretty much, I think, what the far right really wants.
Definitely the Tenth Movement and states' rights advocates definitely are more like more what the Articles of Confederation had to say. I think Tom did a rant a week or two ago about how the way Congress has dealt with foreign policy is a lot like it would have been under the Articles of Confederation, and one of the reasons we have a Constitution, because there was no centralized power. They're very much against, you know, our federal centralized power. They want everything done locally. So, yeah, Confederacy of States is more accurate probably in terms of what they see as a better solution.
Yeah, it's I can't disagree about the, you know, corporation and corporate control of America. Thank you very much for watching there in Michigan.
Which is all the more reason why we may need to start making stronger arguments, if we can, about the benefits of federal government. The benefits of what government, what the purpose is, what it has done, what it can do well, and what it doesn't do well to make it run better. Charles Schumer, Chuck Schumer from New York, gave a brilliant speech about this a few months back about, you know, this is constant undermining since Reagan. You know, government is not the solution, it's the problem. That mentality has been planted and is growing and is blossoming among the right, you know, for what, 30 years now. Having faith in our government, which is us.
Right.
Is important.
You know what I don't understand in this? I'm thinking on the fly, so forgive me if this is a little muddled. But, you know, Republicans, conservatives, and often libertarians, I even think a lot of the DLC third wave Democrats, are all about big business.
Sure.
And they are fine with these monopolies, unitary control of a company or an organization or an industry that controls pretty much the entire industry in our entire nation. You see it with, you know, communications. We see it. You just had Kraft and
Kraft and Heinz are merging. You have airlines merging.
Right.
You know, in the five major sectors, there's only about three or four.
They advocate
actors.
That that's a good thing. That it it brings about cost savings and streamlining and better control, etc. Yet that same principle of things being run from one
centralized
point doesn't hold true for government.
That's interesting. Never thought of that. That's brilliant.
You know, I don't understand how one can be true and
yet
not
they want
to
run government like a business.
Good point.
It makes no sense.
So by that logic, you would want to break monopolies up and create lots of individual pieces and local control.
We should apply their government theory to business.
I'm sure I'm missing something. It can't be that cut and dry. I'm sure people are going to call in and let me know.
I hope so.
Yeah.
But I think you're right, and it's brilliant.
We will have to see. Still waiting for people to call in and let us know what they think about rights that we have under the Constitution or that we've established as a nation that we don't have access to. The ones we came up with, of course, education, voting rights, and, you know, Eighth Amendment rights, mm-hmm. cruel and unusual punishment, why a prisoner doesn't have
privacy rights.
Privacy rights.
Although there are a few conservatives out there who say there's no right to privacy in the Constitution. The word privacy doesn't exist. And for those who are Tom Hartman fans, they know where that rant would go.
Yes. About what privacy meant.
Right.
And if you're not, just put the words in the DuckDuckGo machine or Google, whatever you use. You'll find Tom's rant on it very quickly. Lots more in store. Going to be back with Talk Radio News and Luke Vargas in just a moment.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
What am I missing? If it's okay for business to be ran from one location, why not government? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program.
I have your answer.
Here on Free Speech TV. Okay, Shane, what am I missing?
Well, they're hypocritical in their analysis, but those large corporations in each one of those sectors would see the government as a competitor, as another entity inside of that sector that's going to limit their profits. So therefore, government is a competitor. If you are a company that's interested in consolidating and becoming bigger and bigger and owning more and more of a market share, anyone who gets in that way, i.e. a competitor, you would be against.
I'm certain that there are points that I must not be seeing here because somebody far smarter than me would have made that comparison far long ago.
We'll have to look it up.
Let's check in with the Free Speech TV callers. Let's go with Dan watching on DirecTV in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, Dan.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
We're doing very well, thank you.
We've got a hate group here at South Bend, North Carolina, called the Sierra Club, and they call blacks non-productive and a burden on the environment.
The Sierra Club?
They want to feed them algae. They want to put put Mexicans on these future cities called C40 cities and leave the blacks in the
Dan, I think you are grossly confusing them with another organization, because the Sierra Club, at least as I know of it, S-I-E-R-R-A, I believe Sierra Club, is an environmental group that does a lot of great work, including, you know, helping to fight Keystone. They're not about race or you know, oppressing any particular people except maybe the oil companies.
Got a sustainable development video with Rahi Aguilera. And these others that
Raul Grijalva.
Yeah, I've got the sustainable development. Let's see, food shortage, C40 cities with Dan Glickman. All this, they hate black people.
Okay, thanks, Dan. I think you may have gotten a little Agenda 21 UN conspiracy theory mixed with a little big oil talking points mixed with a little racism. So. Good on you. Let's check in with Jim in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, Jim.
Yeah, I had a question, but I just wanted to see if that that last caller could turn me on to his dealer, because maybe
we have no evidence that he was under mind-altering substances of any kind. We can hypothesize, but we don't have evidence.
Yes, we can assume.
Yes.
So. But anyway, I want to talk about the criminal justice system, and I have a lot of experience in this area. But I wanted to pose a few questions to Shana. And one is that when you're talking about cruel and unusual punishment, what reference point do you use compared to the 19th century, compared to other countries, compared to Afghanistan?
Cruel and unusual is one of those vague terms that you unfortunately have to leave up to Supreme Court justices. And depending on the justice, they're going to use different ones. People like Scalia are going to say, what was cruel and unusual? What did they mean when they wrote the Constitution? More liberal justices are going to say, what's cruel and unusual in the context of society today? But it's one of those movable ideas.
Yeah. Well, in reference to our guest coming up at the top of next hour, Stephanie Mensimer, some of the Supreme Court justices ruled in on some of those ideas, and we can hear her thoughts on it. Jim, I'm sorry. I know you had other questions there. We'll have to save them for another day. We're just out of time and got to get to talk radio news. But thank you. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. Let's see if I can pick Luke Vargas up. I'm not sure if it's working. Is Luke? Are you there?
Hello, can you hear me?
I can. All right.
Terrific.
Good deal. Luke of Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoats.com, and, of course, free-don.org. Go check it out and see what you can do to help Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. Luke, thank you very much for calling in today.
Yeah, you bet.
What's going on in the news?
Well, you know, obviously here at the United Nations, there were a number of, fellow journalists that, sort of tuned away from things happening here in the building to listen to Afghan President Ghani's address to Congress. But I want to start off with, I guess, an item that is much more closer to the agenda here at the United Nations, which are the developments in Yemen. We've heard just within the last hour, that the Yemeni President Hadi has fled the country. Reports from the Associated Press say that he left in a boat. Of course, he had been pushed out of Sana'a, the capital, last month after it was seized by Houthi rebels, and had sort of moved the Yemeni governments down south to the tip of Yemen, to the city of Aden. And as we've seen over the last few days, those Houthi fighters have just kept pushing south relentlessly. They took the Aden airport today. There are reports they're about 12 miles from the center of that city. That would have likely explained this sort of precautionary move by the president to get out of there ahead of time. And we, of course, have been seeing a mobilization of regional powers here. The influence of Iran is talked about quite a lot in the context of Yemen. They're alleged to have provided support to these fighters, the Houthi fighters, over the last few years. But we're also seeing Saudi Arabia, Yemen's northern neighbor, amassing its military along its southern border. Again, the U.S. And American officials have said they don't believe the Saudi government is building up for any sort of offensive push, that we don't believe they're going to be crossing the border in large numbers. And we do know that the Saudis seem to take border security very seriously. But there's been speculation that the Saudi Air Force could intervene at some point if there's a direct attack on government facilities in Aden. And now that we've seen that, which would, you know, was that sort of speculative tripwire, it's unclear what's going to happen next. So there have been a lot of developments today. We haven't seen regional powers begin to interfere quite yet directly here, but there's progress on two fronts. We've got the Arab League meeting tomorrow. They were asked to help put together a military force to fight the Houthis. And then we've got letters from Yemen to the Security Council arriving here in New York last night, asking the Security Council to back some sort of military action against the Houthis, requesting that some sort of coalition of willing countries be formed, that a no-fly zone put in effect against all parties who are not affiliated with President Hadi. So a lot of moving parts here. We don't know how those moving parts, I guess, react to the events we've seen today. But again, with the president out of the sort of temporary capital, that is a major development and just a further sign of how things are falling apart there.
Yeah, I've seen some of these headlines on the TV here over our shoulder. What is the reaction there at the UN? Any rumblings from other nations, other ambassadors, any information that shows maybe which way the U.S. or other countries are going to act on this?
No, obviously the United States has been supportive of President Hadi at the United Nations, as has been the case with the ongoing crisis in Libya. The talk has primarily, not been about entertaining these requests from those countries, sort of leaders in exile who've been asking for military support. There doesn't seem to be a big push there to do that. Of course, it was, when we go back to the intervention in Libya, the Arab League asked the United Nations Security Council to put in place that no-fly zone. That was sort of what allowed a regional, military force to go into Libya in the first place. I think there is still sort of a fear of repeating that exact same pattern here, even if we are dealing with a major crisis. It does not appear at this point that the UN is prepared to do anything more than just endorse talks. I know they've said they'd like to see a gathering of the various political players in the country here, but we have not gotten an indication from the Security Council leaders this month that they are going to, approve this kind of request for a military coalition to form here. They'd much rather talk about the prospect of negotiating this diplomatically, as unlikely as it seems that this could actually be sorted out that way.
Yeah, when the president's fleeing the country, I don't know how diplomatic relations are going to be effective. So what else is being discussed there at the UN? What other big news is coming from the UN building?
Here's something, it doesn't necessarily tie in too closely with the United Nations, though I have spoken with a few energy experts about mm-hmm. this. Jordan today has signed a deal with Russia's nuclear agency, Rosatom, to build a nuclear power plant in northern Jordan. This is a big deal. When I was traveling in Jordan last year on the Syrian refugee crisis, I mean, so many issues in that country came down to the way that Jordan is able, or in many cases unable, to provide reliable and sustainable basic services to its population. And energy has been one of the preeminent concerns. This is a country that imports over 95% of its electricity from other countries, a lot of it from Iraq and Egypt, which of course are having difficulties, at times, with Egypt, but obviously with Iraq actually fulfilling those obligations. And it's caused Jordanian electricity to be sort of on the fritz recently. This is a big deal. It's the latest for Rosatom. I mean, this agency, as much as various countries around the world would like to see, Russia's energy sector unable to strike deals with other countries, we just have not seen this with Rosatom. In the past few months, we've seen them increase deals with Turkey. They're going to be helping Egypt build reactors. It's got projects in Finland and India and Bangladesh. It's supplying nuclear isotopes to Brazil for medical research, and that hopes that's a gateway to more Latin American investments. So in many cases, this nuclear agency has used in many cases Russia's diplomatic issues in other realms to be able to drive a really good bargain, a bargain that makes sense for a lot of countries. And of course, for Jordan, the case is clear. They need to develop some sort of energy solutions within their own borders that can give them a degree. And of course, it's going to be very far from full energy independence, but these two nuclear reactors would, begin the process of making Jordan a little more stable. They're supposed to be finished in 2022, so we'll see.
Luke Vargas of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Luke.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Danielle, here with Shane Owen in for Tom today. If you were holding on the phone, by the way, just please give us a call back. The system crashed.
Seems to do that when we're at guest hosting, doesn't it?
Yes, I think it doesn't like us. But in the meantime, we have the wonderful, the brilliant reporter from Mother Jones Magazine's Stephanie Mensimer about a really stunning article, Executing the Insane is Against the Law, So Why Do We Keep Doing It? Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The article you wrote is the type I think most people probably couldn't put down, just wanting to know what happened to Scott Panetti and how it is that someone like this could be on death row. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about his story? He's such a prime example of what you're talking about here.
Sure. So Scott Panetti is a guy from Texas who had been, I think he'd been diagnosed with psychosis or early schizophrenia as a teenager. And he spent a bunch of years in and out of mental hospitals. And, he was sort of one of those non-compliant patients. He wouldn't take his medication. He didn't think he was sick. But then he would do all these crazy things, like he buried a bunch of furniture and other stuff in his house one time in his yard because he thought it was possessed by the devil. He was really, really delusional. And he eventually shot and killed his in-laws in front of his wife and his toddler. And so he was arrested, and he claimed at the time that the crimes had been committed by Sarge, who was kind of like his alternate personality, and he talked to himself as if he were a cowboy, and he did all kinds of weird things, and he ultimately ended up representing himself in court because he was just delusional. He couldn't get along with his lawyers. He thought they were conspiring against him, and so the judge let him represent himself, and he turned the whole trial into just kind of a circus, and he scared the jurors. He came in wearing a like 10-gallon hat and this sort of Tom Mix, like 1920s cowboy outfit, and he just rambled in front of the jury for several days, and he like picked jurors by flipping a coin. He was clearly nuts, but they let him represent himself, and of course the jury found him guilty and sentenced him to death very quickly. And I think that was in the early 90s, and he's been on death row ever since. And he has made many appeals. He finally got some other lawyers to help him, and he's asserted that he is too mentally ill, too mentally incompetent to be executed, which in theory, should you know, be prohibited by the Eighth Amendment rules against cruel and unusual punishment. And in 2007, the Supreme Court took up his case, and they agreed and said that the state of Texas hadn't adequately assessed his mental health or his, you know, the state of his delusions, and that they hadn't provided a lot of procedural protections to make sure that they weren't executing somebody who was too insane to be executed. And so the case got sent back to Texas in 2007. He was evaluated by some state psychiatrists, among others, and they all said he was fine. There's nothing wrong with him. He's just faking all of this. And so the courts in Texas, including the Fifth Circuit Federal Appeals Court, all said, okay, he's sane. We think he's sane. Go ahead and execute him. And I think it was last year they, late last year, they set an execution date for him, and he came within about a day of being executed before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals intervened again, and so now his case is just kind of on hold while they're doing more proceedings on this issue. So that's a long-winded explanation of his 20-year legal history.
Well, but it I think it's important because he is just an example of a really pervasive problem in our Justice Department throughout the states, not just in Texas, where people who, by any reasonable standard, are certainly not competent to hold trial and to understand the crimes against them, yet not only are they tried and convicted, in cases that you mention and you reference here, they're also executed. How is it that this happens? What low standard is being used to evaluate their mental competency?
Well, and it was actually in Panetti's case, the Supreme Court kind of tightened tightened the rules and said that you have to be, it's not enough. Well, in the old standard was basically that if a person could understand the nature of the crime and the punishment they were about to be given, that was enough to prove them they were competent enough to be executed. But that was such a low standard. I think somebody told me, you know, your dog could meet that. You could be really, really, really delusional and very sick and have half your brain missing, and you could still meet that standard, and you would still be qualified to be executed. And so the Supreme Court changed that a little bit in 2007, and they said it's not enough just to know that the state's going to kill you and why, but you have to have a rational understanding of what they're doing and why. And in practice, that hasn't changed much. Most of the states are still sort of operating on this other threshold question about, you know, as long as the prisoner understands that he's going to be executed because he murdered someone, that's basically enough for them. And that, so there are a lot of people who meet that standard who, if you met them, you would automatically assume they were stark raving mad, but the states are finding them sane enough to execute anyway.
Now, why is it that it seems like some states go to extreme lengths, like in the case of Panetti, to prove that an individual is sane? It's very expensive to keep somebody on death row. It's certainly not good public policy to execute people. You know, what is it that they are hoping to gain by subjecting the mentally ill to what I would certainly constitute as a cruel and unusual punishment?
I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about mental illness in the justice system, as you know, kind of with the public as a whole. They still treat mental illness like something that you could fake. It's not considered like diabetes or heart disease, even though it is a brain, you know, the serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. These are organic brain diseases. You know, you can see them a lot of times on a PET scan. But judges still, I think, and this was the Supreme Court, even in the original opinion back in the 80s on this issue, had the same concerns that, well, if we start letting people off of death row because they're mentally ill, that could open the door to letting out everybody, because there's so many people with mental illness on death row that could, you know, basically get rid of the death penalty for most people in some level. They thought that lawyers would argue that everything qualified as, you know, being too mentally, you know, would be a mental illness that should be exempted. And they still think that people fake. I mean, you know, and it's interesting because they argue that the Texas prosecutors have argued that in Scott Panetti's case, but he had been in mental hospitals before he killed anybody, and he had been in and out of them for a long time before he actually committed a crime. So he would have had to start faking his disease way back in high school in order to fake it all the way, you know, for the past 30 years to try to get out of his execution. So it doesn't make any sense.
It really doesn't. I mean, for me, it begs the question of what is wrong with our justice system, our mental health care system that keeps putting people who have mental illness in prison in the first place, let alone getting to the point of execution. How can people listening weigh in on this and add their voice and, you know, try and say that this should not be done in our name? This should not be what the catchphrase American exceptionalism is all about.
Well, you know, none of these people got to this point without having been sentenced by a jury. So juries are really an important check on this kind of thing, and jurors have the power to say this is kind of barbaric and it doesn't reflect well on our country. And in these cases, nobody's arguing that these people should get out of jail.
Right.
No one is saying that Scott Panetti shouldn't be in jail. He did a really horrible thing, but they're just saying he shouldn't be killed.
Yeah,
that option is available.
It seems like
jury.
A pretty simple request not to kill the unwell and the mentally ill. Stephanie, thank you so much for covering this. You know, prisoners are people who often don't get a voice, especially mentally ill prisoners. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Stephanie Mensimer of Mother Jones.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Just as Stephanie says, if executing prisoners who are insane is against the law, why do we keep doing it? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program on Free Speech TV. Thank you guys for calling back.
Non-commercial radio stations.
Yes, and non-commercial radio stations. Thank you for everybody listening who called back after getting hung up on. I apologize. Let's check in with Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon, watching on the Dish Network. How's it going, Ed?
Oh, just fine. I'd like to point out something to people that they probably don't know, that slavery is still legal in America. Everybody thinks that Article 13 abolished slavery. It did not, not for prisoners. Article 13 says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States.
13th Amendment.
13th Amendment. Actually, our guest, Maya, referenced that point earlier, and I have to say, I did think of you, Ed, because I know you've made that point before.
I tried, but Tom wouldn't let me on the air to say it. I waited hours to say this.
I'm sure he would have let you. Sometimes the calls actually just take that long to go through. But it's an important point that in this day and age, such an atrocity is still, you know, still legal on the books. How does this happen?
It's a loophole to slavery. That's what I see it as. That racists have been able to use this
right
in an institutional type of way. To enforce it disparately against African Americans to keep slavery going, I think that's absolutely right.
They find these loopholes quite often. I mean, look at what they've done to essentially recreate debtors' prisons.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how many people listening watch John Oliver.
Yeah.
We watched a show from, I don't know, maybe a few days ago, last night, that we had on the DVR, and he did a stunning piece on how these for-profit, just to call back from an earlier call, organizations have turned a traffic ticket into debtor's prisons. And it's stunning that in this day and age, we can't do better.
It seems like this, when I'm speaking of that, that they're using the same system that they once upon a time used for fixing your credit. They have these different agencies, and you had to pay them fees, and along with a certain percentage of your credit cards over time to fix your credit. And it was a scam, essentially, where you were just paying the fees to them first and then not the credit card debt. They're doing this now with tickets and with municipal fines and things like that, if anyone hasn't seen it. And what's even worse is it's unlike the credit cards where, you know, you were responsible, you know, for calling them up and saying and getting duped, I guess, unless there's fraud involved. The courts are actually instituting these. They're together with them, and they're using the power of the judge, the power of our justice system, to enforce a contract with a private company. And therefore, if you don't pay them their fees, you end up in jail. That is debtor's prison.
Yep.
If you will not pay a third party under a contract, and you, as a result, you go to prison, that's debtor's prison.
Right, which doesn't help anybody.
No one.
It doesn't, you know, you. Good luck paying that fine once you're in jail. And for the city, the state, the county, whatever institution, it certainly costs a lot more to imprison somebody, whether it be in jail or in, you know, a penitentiary, than it does to help them figure out a way to pay for their parking ticket.
Or let's just make those tickets in line with your income.
Right.
That would solve so much. So much.
Right. We probably don't have time for another call, do we? Right there on cue. There's the music. But we will
pick them up clock noon.
Right after this quick turnaround. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Danielle here with Shano in for Tom. One more quick time, I want to remind you that if you're in L.A. this weekend, March 28th through the 29th, you can go see Tom speak with Dennis Kucinich and Senator Bernie Sanders. Check it out at sistergiant.com or, of course, tomhartman.com or watch it on live stream.
Yeah, I was listening during the last segment about this, the Supreme Court and the standard that they've changed. They increase the standard for what is mental competency to be subjected to the death penalty. I find a huge irony in the fact that the standard is that you have to have a rational understanding of why you're being put to death. When being put to death by your government is, by its definition, in my opinion, irrational.
Excellent point.
How can you rationally understand something that's irrational?
Excellent point.
I mean, it's ridiculous. It's grotesque.
Yeah. This is a really amazing article for anybody who wants to learn more about Panetti, the gentleman we were just speaking about.
Didn't Ted Cruz argue in that case?
Yes. I was trying not to mention Ted Cruz today because we talked about him so much on Monday. But yes, believe it or not.
He was the one who argued that if you let this guy out, lots of people could fake it and everyone, and there's going to be a bunch of murderers marauding the streets.
6 degrees of separation of Ted Cruz. He was the Solicitor General who argued that Panetti should be executed. And just think about that a little bit in context of him running for president, that he argued that a mentally ill person should be killed by the government.
There you go.
Just saying.
Just an aside.
Just throwing that out there. Let's check in with Aaron listening on Sirius in Dubuque, Iowa. Thanks for listening to Sirius, Aaron.
Hi, thank you. A couple things I wanted to touch on. First is what you guys were talking about with the Mother Jones person who was interviewed and stuff. I would love to see the correlation of the privatization of prisons and the skyrocketing number of prisoners.
Yeah, I guarantee it's there.
It absolutely is there. I mean, we have more prisoners than China, and look at our population. So, yeah, there's that. It's all about the money. It doesn't matter. Look at the millions of people, if not, there are thousands of millions that are in jail that are nonviolent crimes, low-level crimes, and mentally ill or drug addicted. And these are diseases. So we're not treating them. We're not rehabilitating them. We're making it worse.
Well, that's why I thought it was so stunning that two Supreme Court justices, Kennedy and Breyer, actually came out and said that this is wrong, that, you know, we shouldn't be using these mandatory minimum sentences and we shouldn't be torturing people in solitary confinement. I think it's big news that those two spoke out, Aaron, don't you?
Absolutely. I think it all in 2015, it all comes down to how much money you have.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Their laws are applied differently for different bank accounts and for normal middle class people. Like my family, who, you know, we work, we've got two kids, just normal average, you know, the laws are applied, you know, right across the board. It's what it is. But if I'm some CEO of whichever company that had laundered trillions of drug money, you know, they just get to pay a fine. They don't have to go to jail.
Good
point. They don't have to really have any penalty for anything because they hide behind the person, quote unquote, that is a company.
Yeah.
So it's really scary. As far as Ted Cruz, which, you know, none of us really want to bring up that name, but how can the fact that he stood for executing this mentally ill person coincide with his religious beliefs at all, which he's very proud of, very outspoken about? I personally don't want to live in a theocracy. He apparently does. So they don't coincide. They're not congruent. They're fighting each other.
Yeah.
It's just telling people what they want to hear. But I wanted to touch base on a previous caller that had talked about the electorate or the Electoral College. You and I both know they're never going to do away with the Electoral College because it's a point of power that they won't willingly give up. But you can pass an amendment or a bill or a law or whatnot stating that the Electoral College has to follow the vote of the constituency.
Right, and the vote in the majority of the state, instead of splitting up the districts like a lot of these states are trying to do, to give electoral votes to the candidate who really isn't supported by the vast number of people in that state.
Exactly.
Right.
If something like that had been in play, our train would not have gone off the track in 2000 because the Supreme Court would have been unlawful for them to appoint George Bush. The vote would have had to have counted, and the Electoral College would have had to follow the people's vote, which would have been Gore.
That's
so,
true.
You know, we kind of diverge realities here. The Supreme Court is taking us into the Twilight Zone. And, you know, I think for us to look back at, you know, a lot of people, and especially the right, they want to wave the flag of the Founding Fathers like none other. But who they were and what they actually stood for is really perverted now. Like, you know, supposedly America was a country born of Christianity. And that is so not true. Jefferson had a lot to say about his fear of the power of the Supreme Court and how he saw what we are sitting in right today, how he saw that coming about, that the Supreme Court could obstruct and abscond with the power and take away the decision that's there.
Yeah, so, you know, I agree. And Aaron, that is the first thing I always think of when we hear people complaining that the president has taken so much power. That's really not what concerns me the most right now. It's actually the Supreme Court and them injecting themselves into our politics, into our laws, creating laws out of thin air, you know, looking at cases besides what's actually in front of them. But you make excellent points on all of them.
And speaking of the Founding Fathers, if you really want to watch a conservative's head explode, whenever talking with them about the Founding Fathers, just remind them that the Founding Fathers were liberals. Their heads explode. It's true. It's true. George Washington said he hoped this would always be a liberal nation.
Yeah.
They were liberals.
But Aaron, excellent points on all of it. Thank you for listening there on Sirius. You know, I think religious people often point to the fact that there is the eye for an eye in the Bible. I believe, though, that a lot of the killing, the death in the Bible is Old Testament.
Sure is.
You know, then Jesus comes along and says, thou shalt not kill. I don't see any clauses, you know, there's not little asterisks by that on the tablet that say, except in these circumstances. For me, I think execution is morally wrong. It costs us way more money than incarcerating somebody for life. And even that, you know, unless it's for murder or for such a horrific crime, I don't think somebody should be in prison for life, but hey.
Yeah, I don't think there's an asterisk in the Hebrew alphabet either.
No.
Sorry.
Shano having too much fun over there. Lots more in store. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Lots of great callers want to weigh in. We're going to get to your calls next. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Danielle here with Shano in for Tom today, taking your calls.
Do you want to share that joke or not?
Sure.
I know we get a lot of flack for covering Ted Cruz, but Ted Cruz is now going on Obamacare, right? Ted Cruz is also the person that did green eggs and ham on the floor of the Senate. So isn't Obamacare the green eggs and ham? He's trying it, and he's going to like it.
Yes. We actually agreed in the studio, I think everybody said so, that we are glad that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is there to make sure his family and his children have health care. We just wish he would stop, you know, wanting bashing to block it for other people and stop bashing it. But, yes, maybe ACA, green eggs and ham. There's the brilliant folks out there, I'm sure, can write some new lyrics for us. New words. I don't know. Anyhow.
Poetry.
Thank you. A new version of Dr. Seuss. Let's check in with Bob listening on Sirius in Los Angeles, California. Thanks for listening to the Tom Hartman, Bob. Bob?
Hello.
Hello. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you. I just want to make a point, and I was listening to you earlier, you know, talking about our elected officials and that, you know, we need to vote these people out who are not, you know, doing what they supposed to do to help people. But yet and still, the people, we're electing these people, But at the same time, the millionaires and billionaires, these are the people who will put these people's faces out there in the public so we can, in turn, vote on them. But once they get elected, they're still beholden to these millionaires and billionaires. At some place in their career, they have to step up to more or less pay back what was given to them. So just like Bill Clinton, at one time, Bill Clinton, when he was going through his problems, everybody was talking about, you know, they were feeling sorry for Bill, and they were talking about how broke he was, you know, after he left the presidency. But right now, Bill Clinton is sitting pretty good because he had to pay back the people who helped get him elected. As with most elected officials or whatever, they're going to get their retirement. They're going to get, their retirement. They're going to get their deal. They're going to get all of these things. And on top of that, they'll end up getting some nice cushy job as a
lobbyist.
Lobbyist.
Think tank.
Yeah. Look at. And, have we heard from Eric Cantor lately? Sorry. Go ahead.
And things of that nature. So nobody is investigating any public official. That leaves elected office. Nobody's ever investigating any of them for where their funding is coming from or where their money is coming from once they leave office.
Well, once they've left office, Bob, I don't think there's anything barring them from getting money from those organizations. It's when they're in office that there are laws governing it, and still not enough laws.
Ask Aaron Schock.
Right.
And there are some rules about lobbying when, as a former representative or senator, I believe it's 2 years right now, but that bars someone from registering as a lobbyist. I think you can work for lobbyists. There's all kinds of different loopholes and things like that. So they aren't an actual registered lobbyist for those first 2 years, but they can go work for a lobbying firm.
Yeah, but Bob, thank you for listening.
So yeah,
there
are definite issues with that.
Yeah, there's no question whether the amount of money in politics is a bad thing. On either side of the aisle, the revolving door between Wall Street and Congress and the White House, it's time for that to stop. But beyond that, you know, movetoamend.org, trying to get money out of politics. You know, of course, millionaires pay a lot of money to get people elected or to help them. And I don't think they're doing it out of the kindness of their heart.
And the Supreme Court calls it gratitude.
Gratitude,
not a bribe,
that's it.
But it's gratitude.
How do you have gratitude in advance?
Preemptory gratitude.
It's preemptory gratitude. That would imply that they will have something to be thankful for?
Yes.
Just saying. Let's check in with Brian in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, watching on Free Speech TV. Thanks for watching the Tom Hartman program, Brian.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for what I can't believe this program is so awesome. You know, I've been calling C-SPAN since the early 90s. And, lately on C-SPAN, it's all they have on there is Republicans. And if it ain't Republicans, it's Republican organizations like the Heritage Foundation. All these foundations that are rich people own. And I told C-SPAN that. And they say, no. But, you know, I try to call in there when there's a congressman or senator on there. And it rings, but no one ever answers. As soon as they're off, and you can call in anytime you want, it rings, they answer.
It's possible. I will say, as somebody who answers phones on a regular basis, while it certainly could be by design, there are times when a topic comes up where the phones are ringing off the hook, and you can only get to so many of them at one time. So I will just have a smidgen of understanding.
But in
people.
Terms of putting these think tanks on, and this is something that Tom has been notating over at National Petroleum Radio, NPR, that they have a vast, complex web of different groups that are whose sole purpose is to take billionaire money, put it through their organization to get their message out in media.
Yeah.
And these companies, a lot of times, if they're getting foundational support from such and such, then they're going to have that point of view on a lot, and it's happening more and more. And I've not heard it happening at C-SPAN, but this is the first I'm hearing. But
it absolutely happens at C-SPAN. Think about it this way, Brian. Excellent point, because C-SPAN covers things like CPAC, conservative events.
I remember
yet you've never seen C-SPAN at Netroots Nation, at, you know, the pretty much the only alternative, you know, to Republican events that they cover is the Democratic National Convention.
Right.
But there are lots of big, huge, what's the word I'm looking for? Events. Anyhow, there are lots of big conferences, conventions by progressives and Democratic organizations that do not get picked up on C-SPAN. So why are they covering CPAC, the conservative organization?
That's a really good point.
You know, Brian, any thoughts on that?
Well, yes. Anyways, what I really wanted to talk about was, the drought in California.
Mm-hmm.
This drought in California, is this going to cause the government to go broke with all these mortgages foreclosing? People ain't going to live in a state where you don't have sewage.
I don't know. I'm sure it's got to have some effect on the housing market, on home values. But with that said, people are still buying property in Miami as water is pretty much hitting the seawall. So I don't know. I'm not a real estate expert, but I can't see how not having access to running water on a regular basis isn't going to affect home values. I don't know how that plays out for the government, but I would certainly wonder if any banks are trading derivatives about it.
And the government also does backstop a good number of mortgages through, HUD. So that's why the question, I think.
It's certainly an interesting question. If anybody has an answer, they're welcome to give us a call over the next couple of days, and we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
Let's check in with Lazaro, listening on Sirius in Valley Stream, New York. Thanks for listening to the Tom Hartman program, Lazaro.
Hey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I was just speaking to the screener, I guess, and it was really great that you mentioned before the thing about where you're going about the Old Testament and New Testament, and I was telling the screener that not that I'm a Bible thumper, but I like to read the book. There's a very simple sentence in John 1, and it's John 1:17, and it's very simple. It says, "For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ."
Grace and truth.
I'll give an example.
Yeah.
Yeah. And truth, with emphasis on the truth. And, let's take one of the commandments, adultery. Through the laws of Moses is thou shalt not commit adultery. And if you do, you're going to be stoned, die. In Jesus's parable, a woman was about to be stoned to death. And he just simply says, well, whoever is, free of sin, cast the first stone.
Right.
They all dropped the stones and they went away. So basically what I'm getting at is that I guess through time, it's always been very convenient for those who want to control to put us in fear. And that's not what Jesus wanted. And this theocracy that we're creating is for those who are in a minority to fear us into being, being controlled. As a majority. And I think that if people just read that sentence, not to be afraid. It's not all about these laws that you have to live, like if I do this, what's going to happen to me?
Yeah.
I
think the world could be a better place if men, and by men I mean, humankind, stopped misinterpreting really peaceful values and messages in religious books in general, but especially in the Bible, that Jesus had some good things to say about how we treat each other, about how we view those who have less, those who, as Lazaro said, have committed acts that we might not agree with or that we might think are contrary to society's needs. And it would be interesting to see those philosophies that Jesus talked about applied to people like Panetti, who we talked about earlier, the mentally ill, the people who don't have income, getting locked away for years at times because they couldn't afford to pay a fee or a ticket. Excellent point, Lazaro. Thank you for listening there on Sirius.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls right after this. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program here on Free Speech TV. Let's check in with Alan watching on the Dish Network in Pierrepont, Ohio. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, Alan.
Hello, Danielle. Shano, good job, guys.
Thank you.
I would like to weigh in on the execution of the mentally incompetent.
It's really a stunning issue, isn't it? In this day and age, such a thing could occur?
Beg your pardon, I could barely hear you.
I said it's a really stunning issue that in this day and age, you know, we could be executing the mentally ill.
Oh, that goes without saying. The thing that, I'm a little up in age, and I remember a time when we had institutions that took care of these people. Now, I'm not against the ACLU. Matter of fact, I support them wholeheartedly. And they came up and challenged the institutions, saying that the people had the right not to take their medication. And the swing of the pendulum on that was that we put them out on the street and allowed them to be a threat not only to themselves.
I don't know that I would agree that the ACLU is the one to blame for the fact that the mental health care system was broken up.
Well, no, there was a suit brought that the people do have the right not to take their medication.
Well, people having the right not to take their medication and dismantling the entire mental health system, I think, are two very different things. I mean, Tom talks about this quite often, about Reagan and dismantling the mental health system and people being left out on the street. It's very convenient at times when something isn't being done, maybe to the best of our ability, to use that as an example or as an excuse to destroy an institution. You know,
right.
just like people who get involved in government and then run it really badly and then say government doesn't work. You know, you defund public schools, you defund mental health care systems, and then say it doesn't function. We need to get rid of it. It's awfully convenient for those who want to destroy institutions like that.
Well, the point that I was trying to make is that we should probably revisit this issue.
Yeah.
So you're saying you want to force people to take medications against their will?
I do not want to force them to take their medication.
Okay.
That's not the point.
Okay.
The point is that at one time, instead of having an army of social workers, we had institutions that were a little more hands-on in dealing with these people.
Yeah, Alan, I think I absolutely agree that we need to revisit
a better mental health infrastructure.
Yeah.
Yes, would be a huge benefit.
Look at the issue we talked about the other day about whether or not police need to be worrying about the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act. You know, what if police had a resource of somebody who was better equipped to handle the mentally ill without a mental health care infrastructure and people available to help them? You know, it's asking a lot more of our law enforcement officers. Not to say that I disagree with them having to consider it, though. Alan, thank you for the call and for your points. We will have to talk about the ACLU point another day. But thank you for watching on Dish Network. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. I'm Danielle here with Shano in for Tom today and taking your calls. Let's check in with Helen listening. Oh, we may be right on the phone system. Let's see. Helen in Ithaca, New York, listening on 1470 AM. Can you hear me, Helen?
Uh-oh.
Oh, there she is.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello, everyone. I'm Danielle, Shano, Troy, and the other members of the team whose names I don't know. I had never heard something. I was chuckling for minutes after, I don't know if Shano came up with that himself, but National Petroleum Radio.
No. That's a Tom.
That's a Tomism.
Oh, okay. That was pretty funny. I wanted to just make two points. One was about the Supreme Court case today, the Alabama Legislative Black Caucus versus the state of Alabama. and gerrymandering. I'm sorry. But, yeah, I am astounded almost that they just put that back to, send it back to a district court. I don't have much confidence in the Supreme Court, and I think that's a positive thing, possibly. Mm-hmm. And, so, and the other thing that you were talking about was the voter registration, and, you know, which has to do with the, what the Supreme Court also did to botcher the Voters' Rights Act. I just wanted to, like, all I know is, like, what the law is really in New York State. This mm-hmm. is where I'm residing right now. But anyone can register anyone to vote. And I've been doing this for several years. If I go to, like, street festivals and mm-hmm. stuff, you know, I used to be on the Democratic Committee. I am no longer on that. I'm really kind of a socialist. But anyhow, who cares about that? But you can get, all you need is a clipboard, a pen, and you can go to your Board of Elections and get a bunch of forms. And you can register anyone to vote.
In the state of New York, yes.
Yeah, in the state of New York. I do want to make sure to tell people to be very careful about that, because I know, for instance, in Florida, they have made past laws making it very difficult to register people for vote.
In fact, they made it so difficult in Florida with so many possible legal liabilities that the League of Women Voters had to pull out of Florida for fear of their members getting tickets.
Arrested?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I know in New York State, you can actually get people who are convicted as felons to vote as long as they successfully completed their parole, you know, and I've gotten people in their 30s and 40s registered to vote, and they were like so ecstatic about it. They had never voted before in their life. And so I'm in a blue state, so it's kind of like I'm preaching to the choir, you know. So in other states, you can do that, but you need to check with your Board of Elections to find out what the rules are.
It all counts, Helen. Even in the blue states, there's still, you know, our state legislatures, our state representatives, our, you know, state ballot initiatives. There are so many important reasons, even in a state where you might agree with the vast majority of your lawmakers, that you need to get out and add your voice.
It's also key to keeping blue states blue.
Right.
If they can turn.
Because they start in the state legislature, even in city councils, and
they lay essentially a voting suppression foundation and infrastructure.
Voting suppression foundation and infrastructure. Gling Shano for the word of the day. Thank you very much, Helen. And I encourage people to check with their individual state and see what the rules are. And if you can, get out there. If you register two people, that's two more votes.
Just start with yourself.
Right.
So
I will
yourself
take
and
it.
Vote.
I will take it. Let's check in with Paul, listening on WCPT.com in Woodinville, Washington. Hi, Paul.
Hey, you guys sound like you're having fun.
We are.
Hey, I have to side with Shano on the. I don't think direct democracy is the way to go.
Okay.
It would be tough.
I heard that discussion. Well, you know, there was a. It's interesting that. You may recall the renowned journalist of the 20th century, his name by the name of Walter Lippmann, two P's, two N's. Walter Lippmann, who founded the New Republic magazine, he was one of the founding editors. He wrote a couple of books in the 1920s. The first one was called Public Opinion in 1923, and one in 1926 was called The Phantom Public. There are two books that talked about how, by and large, initially, public opinion is almost always wrong. So. And it changes so quickly. So if we could change representatives as quickly as public opinion changes, that might be then direct democracy might be an option. But so you were talking about fundamental rights that we all have.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to add to the list. I don't know because some of the early part of the show I didn't hear. I think the right to some economic security in your old age is one fundamental right.
I think that's an excellent addition to the list.
Economic security, if you're disabled, is a fundamental right. Yep. You have a right to health care. And these things kind of starting to sound like something we already have, which is under attack, and it's called Social Security and Medicare.
That's right. Speaking on that subject, Paul, if I may, I believe you'll be at an event this weekend. Maybe you can quickly let people know where they can come out and listen.
Yeah, I'm holding a public forum on Social Security at, for those of you in the Seattle area, at the Kirkland Library on Saturday, the 28th, from 2 to 4 in the afternoon. It's at the Kirkland Library in the meeting room. It's right there as soon as you walk in the door, and we'll be talking about it. I've got some things I want to share about Social Security, what's going on with Social Security, the history of Social Security, not only Social Security, but the history of economic security in our country and some other things that have gone on before Social Security, and why Social Security is the best program we've ever had in this country, and Medicare. We've doing some Government and Civics 101, and, of course, always doing my Supreme Court stuff. It'll be fun. I hope I can, get as many people who are listening on KBCS, that'll be in about 3 hours from now, so that'll be afternoon drive. Swing on by the Kirkland Library in downtown Kirkland.
What? If you're not in the area, maybe consider doing something similar, having a civics conversation in your area.
And I hope Paul's are going to be recording that, because I'd like to hear it
afterwards,
because I'm not in Seattle. I really would.
That would be wonderful. Or maybe if somebody has some audio tech skills, they can show up and give Paul a hand. Paul, excellent points. Healthcare, the right to economic security. Sounds a little FDR-esque.
Yeah,
love it. We'll be back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for hanging out with us here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.